Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, December 28th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the last Sunday of the year. But we begin every Sunday in the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: James Foster Bigler, Gordon L. Bradshaw, Richard P. Casillas, Anne M. DeRose, Linda Gregg Doyle, Alice Isla Feltman, Altine Doris Goodwin, Joe David Grantham, William Francis Kane Jr., known as Bill, Edith Lorraine Knopf, Richard Clark Lazader, David R. Merkel, S. Wade Myers, Diane Charlotte Stanford, Robert B. Tanner, Dennis Raymond Thornton, Richard Lee and Anne Reardon Westfall, Kathleen Margaret Webke. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends his condolences to the families and friends of the people listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. There's just one article in the economy section. It's written by Brooke Edwards for the Florida Today out of the USA Today network. And it's entitled, Would IPO Change SpaceX Mars Plan? SpaceX CEO Elon Musk confirmed the plans to shift from a private to a publicly traded company, news that left many wondering what this meant for the future of the innovative space company and its ambitious Mars settlement goal. In a response on X to a December 10th article from ARS Technica, which addressed the initial reports that the company could use the massive influx of cash from a public offering to lean into AI and data centers in space, Musk confirmed the information to be accurate. Bloomberg reported that SpaceX is considering an initial public offering in mid to late 2026. However, public companies need to cater to their shareholders, and SpaceX's goal of a Mars settlement not only requires considerable funds, but also time, and shareholders are not always the most patient. Abram Walton is a professor and executive director of the Center for Innovation Management and Business Analytics at Florida Tech. Abram said, quote, public markets have a different desire than strategic installation that's provided by single or limited ownership. When you have public markets that are finicky and want their quick win, is that going to amplify the mission and make it better and more exciting? Or is it going to put it more at risk? Unquote. Gene Autry, Associate Provost for Space Commercialization and Strategy at the University of Central Florida, said not to count out SpaceX's Mars aims. Gregg said, quote, the purpose of any company is to serve the needs of its customers so that basically it can extract money from the customers in order to pay for what the business does, create profits to further grow the business, and pay shareholders off, unquote. He said at some point those who put money into the company will deserve a return on their investment. But, he said, it will also be vital that SpaceX cater its customers. And that's where the Mars goal might come in. He said it's very important to realize that one of SpaceX's customers might be somebody who, after the IPO, has $1 trillion and would like to go to Mars, unquote. He said Musk will have substantial financial resources. He certainly hasn't lost his strong interest in establishing a presence on Mars. While Musk could leverage various companies to support his efforts, SpaceX is likely to be the primary choice to get the job done. Autry went on and said, quote, that does not conflict with the obligations of the leadership at SpaceX or the boards for the shared commitment to the shareholders to generate profits, unquote. Now, speculation about SpaceX going public has been building for weeks. On December 5th, the Wall Street Journal reported SpaceX was considering a secondary share sale, which would value the company at $800 billion. Meanwhile, Reuters has reported an unnamed source that claimed SpaceX plans to raise more than $25 billion. But after those early December media reports, Musk took to X to claim they were not factual. Musk wrote this, quote, SpaceX has been cash flow positive for many years and does periodic stock buybacks twice a year to provide liquidity for employees and investors. Valuation increments are a function of progress with Starship and Starlink and securing global direct-to-cell spectrum that greatly increases our addressable market, unquote. The company owns and operates the Starlink Internet service and frequently launches satellites from Florida and California, providing satellite internet in some of the most remote places on Earth. SpaceX is also the leading launch service provider for NASA, with government and commercial payloads. Still, it is Starlink which generates the majority of SpaceX profits. The company is developing in its next-generation launch system called Starship in Texas. The massive vehicle is designed to carry significantly more payload, including Starlink satellites, and to be fully reusable. Abhi Tripathi, who is director of the Mission Ops Space Science Laboratory at University of California at Berkeley, said Musk previously mentioned he liked the idea of more people being able to buy into SpaceX, specifically retail investors. While the assumption was there would eventually be an IPO, there was not a pressing reason to do so until now. Ars Technica reported that Musk is seeking a convergence of all his technologies. Musk owns xAI and has been innovating with smart driving technology and robotics within Tesla. The next generation of SpaceX Starlink satellites could become the foundation of an AI data center in space. Tripathi said, quote, so I think now is the first time where you're starting to see that there might be an anchoring point. An anchoring point might be the need to fund space-based AI data centers, which would, of course, consume a lot of capital, unquote. SpaceX already has thousands of powerful Starlink satellites in orbit. Tripathi explained that SpaceX could easily utilize future versions of the satellites as data centers. And that was the article, Would IPO Change SpaceX's Mars Plan? Well, we're coming up on 9 minutes past the hour. Time for us to move on over to the sports section of the paper. The cover story is all about football and the college football playoffs. The article is entitled, Here's How We See the CFP Quarterfinals Playing Out. It was written by Bob McManaman, a columnist for the Arizona Republic. The college football playoff quarterfinals are nearly upon us, meaning we are inching closer to our Fiesta Bowl semifinal game en route to crowning a national champion. Before we get to the title game on January 19th in Miami, and the pair of games that will determine the two semifinalists, which will be the January 8th Fiesta Bowl and the January 9th Peach Bowl, it's time to debate and rate the four games coming later this week. So for that exercise, we decided to phone a friend for help, and we called upon former NFL linebacker Sam Acho, who spent the first four of his 9 pro seasons with the Arizona Cardinals, and he serves as a college football analyst for ESPN. Acho was in the radio booth on Saturday, December 20th, calling the CFP first-round matchup between 6th-seeded Ole Miss and number 11th-ranked Tulane in Oxford, Mississippi, and he watched the Rebels roar to a 41-10 victory in their first game since the defection of coach Lane Kiffin to LSU. Now, more on that later, but first things first. Here's how we decided to break down the CFP quarterfinal China matchups. The CFP quarterfinals, number 2-ranked Ohio State, 12-1 record, versus the number 10th-ranked Miami with an 11-2 record. This will be in the Cotton Bowl in Arlington, Texas on Wednesday, December 31st, 5:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on ESPN. Now, Mac says, Sam, this is one as easy as it looks like for the Buckeyes. And Sam responds, no, not at all. Miami gave up only 3 points to 7th-seeded Texas A&M. I think Ohio State is really good, and I'd probably pick Ohio State to win. And I would say, but don't overlook Miami. And Sam responds, don't overlook Miami. Correct. A lot of people didn't expect Miami to make it this far. They didn't give up much defensively, and they made plays when they needed it the most. They had a pick in the end zone to win the game. McManaman says, yeah, it was a crazy game. It was windy as heck, and there were 4 missed field goals combined. And Sam responds, you're correct. Now, Ohio State has one of the best defenses, and wide receiver Jeremiah Smith could swing the game. He didn't win the Fred Biletnikoff Award as the best receiver, even though he was 6th in voting for the Heisman Trophy. He posted a tweet pretty much saying he was going to go scorched earth. So, Jeremiah Smith could be the difference maker in that matchup. McManaman says, the Buckeyes also have 2 potential top 10 NFL draft picks in safety Caleb Downs and linebacker Arvell Reese, who are as good as it gets. I don't see how Ohio State loses this one, Sam. And Sam responds, well, Miami has playmakers as well, like receiver Malachi Toney, the true freshman. He's a do-it-all kind of guy. But Ohio State has been off for a while, and that's another thing that could play into it. You never know. The next CFP quarterfinal is number 4th-ranked Texas Tech with a 12-1 record against number 5-ranked Oregon, also with a 12-1 record. This will be in the Orange Bowl in Miami Gardens, Florida, on Thursday, January 1st, 10 a.m. Mountain Standard Time on ESPN. McManaman said, ooh, Oregon took care of James Madison 51-34 in the opening round, but this one scares me, Sam. What do you think? And Sam responds, yeah, Oregon looked really bad defensively. They couldn't stop James Madison, but James Madison couldn't stop them either. They didn't have the athletes to compete. They haven't been overly impressive all season long. Mac said, so, you like Texas Tech in this one, like me? And Sam says, well, they have one of the very best defenses when it comes to stopping the run. They have Jacob Rodriguez, the linebacker who finished 5th in the Heisman voting and forces a lot of turnovers. And they have a safety, Cole Wisnowski, the transfer who won a couple of championships at North Dakota State, so he knows how to win. Having a guy there who knows what it's like is a positive. McManaman said, the offensive lines might be a little suspect for both teams here, but I really like Oregon quarterback Dante Moore. I wouldn't mind seeing the Cardinals draft him in April if they can maneuver their way to get him. What say you? And Sam says, I don't know. I haven't been overly impressed by Dante Moore, being honest, to trade up. Then, the next game is the CFP quarterfinals where number 1-ranked Indiana with a 13-0 record is going to play number 9th-ranked Alabama with an 11-3 record. And this is in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, on Thursday, January 1st, at 2 p.m. on Mountain Standard Time on ESPN. Now, Mac said, quote, well, you've got to love the Hoosiers quarterback Fernando Mendoza, the Heisman Trophy winner, right? What fancies you on the Indiana-Alabama game, besides this being the first time the schools have ever met? And Sam responds, Fernando Mendoza. And Max said, yeah, he is so difficult not to like, isn't he? And Sam says, yeah, and they've been clutch, let's put it that way. Like, that team has been clutch from start to finish. And that's not an accident. That breeds confidence. They believe, put it that way, which is super positive. Their running game is good. Their defense is good. Max said, and their coach, Kurt Cignetti, is great. And Sam says, yeah, coach is great. Bingo. Two-time coach of the year. They've been here before, just a year ago. I think they're going to try and use their experience to say, hey, man, last time we got into the playoff, we got embarrassed. That's not going to happen again. And Max says, well, what about Alabama? They've got three losses, Sam. And Sam responds, nah, one of those was to Georgia. They're playing with a lot more confidence now. I like Indiana in this matchup because I think they're the best team in college football. But Alabama quarterback Ty Simpson, he's playing really well too. I think he's a first-round pick. Max says, good enough for the Cardinals? And Sam says, I'd rather trade back and get him than trade up and get Dante Moore. Put it that way. Then the last quarterfinal game will be number 3rd-ranked Georgia, 12-1 record, versus number 6th-ranked Ole Miss, also with a 12-1 record. This will be in the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans, Louisiana, on Thursday, January 1st, 6 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on ESPN. And McManaman says, okay, I've got a soft spot for Ole Miss just because of the way Kiffin bolted. But you saw their first round win over Tulane. What's your take on this one? And Sam responds, well, one of the questions I had was, how will they respond under their new coach? And how would Pete Golding manage not only the defense, but the entire team? They did a real good job. The defense gave up a lot of yards, which wasn't encouraging, but they gave up very few points. The offense was streaky. Max says, what can you tell me about their quarterback, Trinidad Chambliss, the transfer from Ferris State? And Sam responds, well, he won a Division II national championship. He is a big-time leader. He's super humble. He went down in that game against Tulane, but he did come back. What I really like is they have a deep running back room, and I like their receivers, too. Max says, Georgia beat Ole Miss 43-35 back on October 18th. What do you like about the Bulldogs, who won the national title in 21 and 22? And Sam says, they should be playing with a lot of confidence. They beat Texas by 25 points on November 15th. They held Alabama to -3 rushing yards on December 6th. And their quarterback, Gunnar Stockton, is a winner. People like to say he's more of a running quarterback, but when he needs to make critical throws, he did. Just like in that Tennessee game, that 44-41 overtime win on September 13th. And Max says, all right, Sam, so who are your favorites to play for the national championship? And Sam says, well, now don't hold me to this, but I think I had Indiana playing Georgia and Indiana beating Georgia in the Natty. I've got to see if Alabama made the necessary pass protection changes that can have them potentially beating Indiana. That would be the only thing. And Max says, I'm with you, Sam, and I predict the Hoosiers will win it all. But, like I said, I really have a soft spot this year for Ole Miss. Go Rebels! And that was the cover article entitled, Here's how we see the CFP quarterfinals playing out. Our next article from the interior of the sports section is about Suns basketball. Road trip ends with Ott facing X team by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic. The Phoenix Suns will continue a 4-game road trip on December 29th against the Washington Wizards after playing the New Orleans Pelicans in a back-to-back after Christmas. The Wizards have had one of the worst records in the NBA this season, while the Suns are playing above the preseason expectations. Phoenix will conclude the 4-game road trip on New Year's Eve against the Cleveland Cavaliers in Suns head coach Jordan Ott's return game against his former team. Ott was an assistant last season with the Cavs, who had the best record in the Eastern Conference in 24-25. He spent one season as an assistant in Cleveland. Ott beat out fellow Cavs assistant Johnny Bryant for the Suns' head coaching job after both were finalists. Bryant remains an assistant in Cleveland under Kenny Atkinson, the 24-25 NBA Coach of the Year. The Suns were 1-1 against Eastern Conference teams this season. They beat the Indiana Pacers 133-98 on November 13th, but they lost to the Atlanta Hawks 124-122 on November 16th. Phoenix will then return home for two games against the Sacramento Kings on January 2nd and the defending NBA champion Oklahoma City Thunder on January 4th. The Suns are 2-0 against the Kings and 0-2 versus the Thunder. Phoenix will continue to be without Jalen Green, who will be reevaluated in 1 to 2 weeks for a right hamstring sprain. This is after being on a 4 to 6 week reevaluation period. He first suffered the injury in training camp and has re-injured his right hamstring twice since. Green did not miss a game in his last two seasons with the Houston Rockets. The Suns acquired Green from Houston in the Kevin Durant trade before the 2025 NBA draft. And that was the article, Road Trip Ends with Ott Facing X-Team. Our next article is entitled, Sun Bowl Highlights Busy Week of Athletic Events. This was written by Emily Horos for the Arizona Republic. Arizona State football's New Year's Eve date with Duke in the Tony the Tiger Sun Bowl highlights a week of athletics. The Sun Devils and the Blue Devils kick off at noon MST Mountain Standard Time in El Paso, Texas on December 31st. Plenty has been written about the upcoming bowl game, but still, fans should know that a new group of Sun Devils will play feature roles after numerous players either declared for the NFL draft or their intention to enter the transfer portal. Among the positions we will be watching are the defensive secondary and the offensive backfield. Fans might also get a glimpse at the quarterback of the future. Then there's women's basketball trying to extend their streak. The ASU women's basketball team remains undefeated as Big 12 play continues with a trip to Utah on Wednesday, December 31st, and then on to BYU on Saturday, January 3rd. ASU is 14-0 on the season and 1-0 in the Big 12. The Sun Devils are outscoring opponents by an average of 15 points per game. Then we have Coach Bobby Hurley and the ASU men's team surprising Texas during non-conference play. They were picked to finish last in the Big 12. The Sun Devils will host Colorado on Saturday, January 3rd, to begin conference competition. Guard Mo Odom leads ASU in scoring with 16.2 points per game and in assist with 6.2 points per game. Then the Sun Devils men's hockey team plays the second of two games at number 8th-ranked Dartmouth on December 28th. The teams also played on December 27th. The team will have a few days off before hosting the Desert Hockey Classic, which will feature Michigan Tech, Air Force, and Alaska Anchorage on January 2nd and 3rd. And finally, Sun Devils wrestling. They travel to Brookings, South Dakota, to face the South Dakota State Jackrabbits in a January 2nd duel. ASU, record is 0-4, is still looking for its first win. In its most recent outing, ASU lost to Wisconsin by a score of 26-15. And that was the article, Sun Bowl Highlights Busy Week of Athletic Events. Our next article is about college football and the recent coaches' problems. It's entitled, Whittingham, a Solid Choice for Michigan's Next Coach. It was written by Blake Topmeyer. He's a college football columnist for the USA Today Network. Here's what he wrote. Michigan cannot close the Sharon Moore chapter of its program history quickly enough. The Wolverines have finalized a deal to hire Kyle Whittingham, the former longtime coach at Utah. Whittingham has gone 177 wins, 88 losses at Utah, including two Pac-12 titles and a 10-win season in the Big 12 this year, and the Utes contended for the college football playoff. So here's how we would grade the hire. Grade B, Michigan. It's hiring a better coach than the one it fired. The Wolverines booted a national disgrace in Moore. In finalizing a deal with Whittingham, it lands a career winner. He's a portrait of stability for a university that needs scandals to subside. Yes, indeed, Whittingham's an upgrade on Moore. He's not just the home run that a couple of other apparent targets could have been. Plundering Alabama's Kalen DeBoer or Arizona State's Kenny Dillingham would have counted as a significant flex for Michigan. Whittingham counts as a secure, if unremarkable, landing after a tumultuous few weeks. Moore's shame became Whittingham's gain. He leveled up. At age 66, he is embracing one of the greatest challenges of his career. He'll have the backing of Michigan's impressive resources as he encounters bigger expectations than he faced at Utah. Earlier this month, Whittingham announced that he was stepping down at Utah, but not retiring after this season. He made way for the coach-in-waiting successor, Morgan Scalley. So long as Whittingham's fire still burns hot, never mind his age. He's just 2 years older than Kurt Cignetti, Indiana's revelation. It's fair to have questions about the hire of a coach who's never worked inside the Big Ten or east of the Mountain Time Zone. For one, will Whittingham successfully recruit the 4- and 5-star talent that Michigan requires to chase the highest levels of success that it craves? Whittingham made his hay at Utah by mostly signing and developing 3-star talent from west of the Mississippi River, and that worked well enough for the Utes. But that approach won't allow him to tussle with Ohio State, Oregon, or Indiana. How lofty will Michigan's ceiling be under a coach who usually lost Utah's clashes against ranked opponents while winning most of the rest of his games? Consider Whittingham's final season at Utah a microcosm of his career. The Utes lost to Texas Tech and Brigham Young, the Big 12's two best teams, but they beat everyone else. Last year, Utah endured a 7-game losing streak while playing a freshman quarterback and navigating a schedule that included multiple ranked opponents. Whittingham earned his reputation as a no-nonsense, line-of-scrimmage coach. His teams are built on physicality that should translate to the Big Ten. His brand of ball, plus his track record for player development, should maintain a stable floor of respectability. He posted a winning record in 18 of 21 seasons coaching Utah. Whittingham never had a quarterback drafted during his Utah tenure. Makes you wonder about the future of Michigan's quarterback position and the incumbent starter, Bryce Underwood, a former 5-star recruit. Can Whittingham assemble the amount of skill position talent you see on the playoff rosters at Ohio State or Oregon or Indiana? Can he develop a Heisman Trophy winner like Indiana's Fernando Mendoza or a first-round NFL prospect like Oregon's Dante Moore? There are more relevant questions. Whittingham is a solid transitional choice. Before the season, our crew at USA Today ranked Whittingham at number 12 on our list of best college football coaches. Moore, by comparison, did not rank in our top 25. Moore landed in jail, and Michigan fell forward. Considering the timing and the circumstances, Michigan could have done worse than hiring someone with a .668 career winning percentage. Now don't expect Cignetti to tremble at the sight of Whittingham in the Big Ten, but the Wolverines can be competent and respectable under his leadership, if not elite. And that was the article, Whittingham, a solid choice for Michigan's next coach. We're at 30 minutes past the hour, so we're going to have to leave the sports section and move on over to the viewpoint section and read some opinion pieces. Our first opinion piece was written by Raina Montoya. It's entitled, A Christmas Apart. 22 years ago, our neighbors welcomed us with homemade Christmas cookies. As a little girl, we did not know a word of English. My family and I were embraced by the compassion of an Arizona family. To them, my family and I were strangers. As years passed by, I witnessed our families waiting together in community for the new year as we looked in the sky and saw the fireworks brighten up our neighborhood in Mesa. This weekend, I received a text letting me know that a church friend had been detained by ICE and was looking for help. I was reminded how beautiful and complicated the holidays can be to close to 1 million Arizonans who were not born here, but have become an essential part of the fabric of our Arizona community. I immediately thought of my father, who spent the Christmas of 2012 separated from us as he fought his immigration case, which he did win years later. It was our first Christmas apart. Unfortunately, my family is not the only one. The United States has the world's largest immigration detention system, and private for-profit detention facilities dominate this system. In July 2023, 91% of the people detained by ICE were held in private prisons. And when we zoom into Arizona, it houses one of the largest for-profit detention centers in Eloy, with a capacity of 1,550 detainees a day. ICE estimates that the cost of each bed at such facilities is an average of around $165 per day. Contrary to the many attempts of this administration to mislead the American public about ICE arrest, data from the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse showed that more than 70% of people currently in ICE detention have no criminal conviction. As Arizonans take time to celebrate this holiday season with their loved ones, it is evident that ICE continues to double down on unnecessary cruelty. Just 3 days before Christmas, they leveraged AI to create a video with Santa Claus stating the following: Avoid ICE Air and Santa's Naughty List. Self-deport today with the CBP Home app, earn $3,000, and spend Christmas at home with loved ones. The holiday incentive is valid through the end of 2025. What gives me solace in the face of cruelty is to remember that Arizonans are compassionate and have the clarity, courage, and conviction to be fair and see that immigrants are our neighbors and know that this is their home too. A recent poll by the Pew Research shows that more than half of Americans believe that Trump administration is doing too much to deport immigrants in the U.S. illegally. Approximately 52% of Latinos fear someone close to them could be deported. That's up from 42% last March. During this holiday season, let us remember that Arizonans deserve better. We deserve a government that works for us, that is going to focus on the economy, safety, and common sense immigration solutions. Arizona's prosperity is tied to the cultural and economic contributions of our neighbors, including immigrants. I invite you to reflect on the words of Pope Francis, quote, "The encounter with the migrant, as with every brother and sister in need, is also an encounter with Christ," unquote. Let's ensure that Arizona is also known for 5 additional C's: compassion, courage, community, conviction, and clarity, as we witness false information about each other. And that was the opinion piece written by Raina Montoya. Raina is the founder and CEO and board chair of Aliento, ALIENTO, serving students, dreamers, and immigrant families in Arizona. Our next opinion piece was written by Sybil Francis, a guest columnist. It's entitled, Stop Asking What Arizona's Future Cost. Ask What It Returns. Here's what she wrote. We often hear that the government should operate more like a business. What people usually mean is, stop looking only at what things cost and start paying attention to what they return. Businesses do not make long-term decisions based on price tags alone. They ask what an investment will produce over time, whether it will strengthen their workforce or expand opportunity and position them for the future. At the Center for the Future of Arizona, we wanted to apply that same lens to public priorities in our latest research. Not just what will this cost, but what would Arizona gain if we actually acted on the priorities that Arizonans share? We commissioned Rounds Consulting Group to conduct an independent economic analysis, published in a new report called Unlocking Potential. It looks at five priorities broadly supported by Arizona voters through a simple lens, return on investment. It puts concrete numbers behind long-term choices, showing what Arizona could gain when we act on priorities that voters already support. The results are powerful, and they clearly demonstrate the benefits of thinking beyond the next budget year or election cycle. Let's start with children. Arizona's lack of affordable, reliable care isn't just an inconvenience for families, it's a real barrier to economic participation. CFA research has found that parents across the income spectrum report that the cost and limited availability of childcare are preventing them from returning to work or school. When parents are sidelined, the effects ripple outward. Fewer people in the workforce, fewer paychecks, less tax revenue, less disposable income circulating through local businesses and communities. Expanding childcare access and affordability could generate more than $12 billion in annual economic output and support over 115,000 jobs and free up about $9,300 more per household each year. That's not just a family issue. It's a workforce infrastructure and economic fuel. To put that scale in perspective, estimates often put at the economic lift of hosting a Super Bowl at around $1 billion. Housing affordability matters just as much. When households are stretched by rent or mortgage payments, the trade-offs are immediate and personal. Savings disappear. Local spending shrinks. People take jobs farther from home or turn down opportunities altogether. Those choices add up for Arizona. When workers cannot afford to live near where jobs are growing, productivity suffers, and the state becomes less competitive in attracting and keeping the people who power our economy. Reducing household cost burdens to 30% of income would free up roughly $8,900 per household each year and unlock more than $13 billion in statewide economic gains and support over 126,000 jobs. That's money that families can save, invest, and spend locally, and the stability that helps employers retain talent. These are just a couple of examples. Each priority delivers a return on its own and even greater gains when we advance them together. It may cost something to act, but when the return is greater, it is a smart investment. These aren't personal handouts. They are public goods that strengthen our economy and help families thrive, a virtuous circle. The report findings are not a finish line. They are a beginning. Shared priorities are common ground. Acting on them builds stability, strengthens our workforce, supports the kind of sustainable growth Arizonans want for the long term. As we head into a new year and a new legislative session and consider the choices we have ahead, we have a real opportunity to be responsive to what Arizonans care about most. The pull of short-term pressure is always there. But unlocking potential gives us something we rarely have in the heat of public debate: clear data that helps us step back, look ahead, and see what Arizona can gain when we invest where the voters already agree. CFA will continue expanding this work, listening to Arizonans, measuring returns, and sharing actionable data that helps leaders move beyond short-term thinking. Acting on those priorities is an investment in ourselves and in Arizona's long-term success. And now we know the return on acting is real. It is measurable, and it is within reach. And that was the opinion piece written entitled "Stop Asking What Arizona's Future Cost, Ask What It Returns," written by Sybil Francis. Sybil has a PhD and is chair and president and CEO of the Center for the Future of Arizona, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that brings Arizonans together to create a stronger and brighter future for our state. And now we're going to read some letters to the editor. Those are opinion pieces written by people like you and me. Our first letter goes like this. It requires an honest look in the rearview mirror to be certain we are moving in the right direction. In 1969, as a new Arizona science teacher, I was lucky to get a job in Phoenix because there were multiple applicants for every opening. In my science department, everyone had a master's degree or doctorate, as well as a modest home and no government educational debt. Cutting edge was a slide rule, a mimeograph, and a slide projector. In that environment, we were eventually able to fill 5 classes of AP dual enrollment physics and 10 classes of college physics. Today, that same school employs few teachers that have a master's degree, many that have no degree in teaching, and are hired as simply long-term substitute teachers. Ask yourself if today's alternative is an educational alternative is an improvement or a political construct that has created a billion-dollar deficit, a severe teacher shortage, and an insane system where parents can purchase a golf simulator as an educational device. Politicians created this monster, but voters have the power to change the narrative. Signed, Earl Barrett in Phoenix. Our next letter goes, as a former Phoenix resident and longtime ASU fan, I'm pleased to see the long-term contract with Kenny Dillingham. At the same time, I'm very displeased that ASU will no longer be supporting NewsHour West on PBS. If ASU has the funding to support their athletics program, I am certain they can find the funds to support an excellent educational program for both students and citizens. I do not understand or agree with this decision, and wonder if Michael Crow, along with other university presidents, has been intimidated by the Trump administration. Our community and nation deserve better. Signed, Tom Gagan, Rancho Mission Viejo, California. Could someone explain to me, as a 20-year-plus Arizona Cardinals season ticket holder, why the prices have increased again and are now double the price from where they were in 2022? The first automatic payment for 2026 was Monday, and conveniently, all calls to the season ticket holder line are going to voicemail. 10 wins out of a possible 33 at home over 4 years is abysmal at best. The team continues to live in mediocrity, hampered by an organization only interested in the amount of money the team can generate at the expense of providing a quality product on the field. The addition of premium field seats with TVs for fans was the gimmick last year, with the cheerleaders resigned to 30-second timeout appearances when they can run on and off the field in time. This year, they added a VIP section, Casa Roja, please, on the 50-yard line, which has just one purpose. Is it any wonder the stands are dominated by away fans each game? It's almost always a guaranteed win for them. See this year as another example of that. Disappointed fan. Signed, Michael McAtamney in Peoria. Well, we're coming up on 45 minutes past the hour, so we're going to have to move on over to the entertainment section of the paper and begin by reading today's horoscopes. We begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Emotional triggers strike close to home. Break the pattern. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, your subconscious may fire up hidden anguish that is ready for release. Grab a pencil, get your feelings on paper. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, comparing yourself to others can sting. Your buried insecurities are revealed. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, tension between purpose and identity can bring up complex emotions and reopen old doubts. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, prepare for your faith to be tested. For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, a friend may offer wisdom that is hard to swallow. Acknowledge what hits a nerve today. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, watch for making impulsive decisions that emotional triggers may drive your professional trajectory. Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st, your daily work and health regimens may be under scrutiny. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, creative or romantic intensity touches on buried pain. Reframe this discomfort. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th, relationship growth can shake your emotional foundation. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th, holes are poked in old insecurities about competence and productivity. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Your inner child may be cranky today. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. Dear Abby, my ex-husband and I were best friends. We shared everything, dreams, laughs, struggles. I was convinced we'd grow old together. When he proposed, I said yes without hesitation. We had plans to start a family, but he asked me to wait until we purchased a home. I waited 5 years, trusting that the dream we had built together was still alive. In time, we bought our house, but when I asked about having children, something had shifted. He told me he no longer wanted kids. I was heartbroken. The life we had talked about for years suddenly dissolved. Soon after, he invited his mother, sister, brother-in-law, and their daughter to move in with us. I tried to be understanding, but I began feeling like a guest in my own home, like he loved me but prioritized them. Eventually, he told me he was moving out. He bought a condo and moved with his entire family. And I was left alone, emotionally and physically. I have tried to convince myself that this was never really about the kids, but I can't shake the guilt. Part of me keeps thinking if I had said no to children, would he have stayed? Even now, years later, I still care for him and cannot seem to let go. I don't know how to move forward when someone who was once my everything still occupies so much of my heart, even if he is no longer in my life. How do I let go of someone who let go of me so easily? Signed, Dream Destroyed in Virginia. And Abby responds, Dear Dream, you feel guilty for having wanted children after your husband led you on for years pretending that he did? You were grossly misled and then deserted. If that reality hasn't been enough to help you let go, then what you need is professional help from someone who is licensed to give it. You are clinging to the fantasy of this person, not the reality. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, my retired husband of 15 years, Seth, is pushing me to the edge of divorce. He's extremely negative, verbally abusive, and estranged from many friends, which has harmed my relationships with friends and family. He drinks almost all day. Now, I drink as well. He calls me horrible names I won't repeat, and refuses to respect my sleep needs because I'm still working. He thinks he's being funny when he acts this way. Seth doesn't hear well, so he talks softly, and this also leads to unnecessary arguments. I love Seth, but I feel like he is destroying my spirit and who I am. I used to be an independent, capable person. Now I feel like I'm always walking on eggshells. I dread coming home from work some days. I just want to run away. Your thoughts? Signed, End of My Rope in Idaho. And Abby responds, Dear End, go online to al-anon.org/info. Find a location near you and attend some of the meetings. Then, if you are really at the end of your rope, draw the line with your disrespectful, alcoholic, verbal abuser. Tell him loudly, when he's a little more sober than usual, that you have had it, and that if he doesn't stop drinking, his marriage is over. And then save yourself and follow through. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. Now it's time to take a look at some comics. In the comic strip Zits, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, there's just two frames. In the larger first frame, it's Mom, and she's stirring something in a pot on the stove, and she's holding a phone in her hand, and she's looking at the phone, and she says, So I was talking to my sister Janet on Friday, and she said her hairdresser's boyfriend puts a little sherry in his bolognese sauce. Sherry, are you sure? I said, because I had never heard of that. So I was wondering if you think I should try. That was in the first frame. And in the second frame, Jeremy pops up and says, Mom, more question, less context. And Mom says, I was just being polite to the AI. And that was Zits. And in the comic strip, Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. In the first frame, Lieutenant Fuzz is sitting at his desk looking at his computer, and he thinks, I just can't think today. And in the next frame, he's walked over to the printer, and he thinks the general isn't going to like this. And in the next frame, he's walking to the general's office, and he's holding something in his hand, and he's thinking, he'll probably really be mad at me. In the next frame, he hands a paper to the general, and he says, Here's my report, sir, and I must apologize. I had writer's block, so it's only one page. And General Halftrack jumps out of his chair, pats the boy on the back, and says, Excellent work, my boy. And that was Beetle Bailey. In the comic strip, Peanuts, drawn by Charles Schulz, featuring good old Charlie Brown, in the first frame, there's Lucy sitting at her little booth, psychiatric help. But at the bottom of the booth, it says, winter rates, 7 cents. And Charlie Brown comes up and says, winter rates, 7 cents? May I ask why your rates go up in the wintertime? And Lucy explodes and says, I don't have to answer that question. By golly, we doctors get tired of all the criticism from you laymen. It makes us nervous. We're very sensitive, you know. It takes a sensitive person to be able to do what we do. We can't stand all this constant criticism. In the next frame, she's wondering, where'd he go? And in the last frame, she says, stupid layman. He didn't even wish me Happy New Year. And that was Peanuts. And in the comic strip Pickles, drawn by Brian Crane, Earl's sitting on the sofa reading his paper. Christmas tree's over to the right. The dog is laying on the sofa next to him. And Pickles comes in and says, "Earl, I need your help." And he goes, "Oh?" And she says, "Yeah, I've got all these leftover Christmas goodies, you know, the cookies, pies, cakes, chocolates, the turkey, the stuffing, the ham, the gravy, the rolls." And then Earl gets up from the couch and starts to walk away. And she goes, "Hey, where are you going?" And he says, "Changing into my stretchy pants." And that was Pickles. And in the comic strip Foxtrot, drawn by Bill Amend, the wife comes in and she sees her husband eating at the breakfast table. And she's got her coffee cup in her hand and she says, "You're eating a dozen donuts for breakfast?" And he says, "It's to help me lose weight." And she says, "That makes no sense." And he says, "Hear me out. My plan is to end the year eating so much fattening and unhealthy food that I'll become sick and tired of it. That way, when I start my New Year's diet, all of the low-cal, healthy food will seem like a refreshing change." And she says, "Well, that is," and he butts in and says, "genius, pure brilliance, the most incredible dieting idea ever?" And she says, "Well, you weren't wrong about the word incredible." And then he yells to his son, "Hey, Peter, what time does Luigi's open? I want to order some pizzas for lunch." And that was Foxtrot. Before we go, we'd like to wish happy birthday to some celebrities who are celebrating today. The TV host Don Francisco turns 85. Singer and songwriter Martha Wash turns 72. Gail King, the TV news host, turns 71. Actor and director Denzel Washington turns 71. Actress Elaine Hendricks turns 55. TV host Seth Meyers, comedian, actor, writer, he turns 52. Actor Joe Manganiello turns 49. And actress, model, designer Sienna Miller turns 44. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for the last Sunday of 2025, December 28th. Have a great day.